or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
It is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. I have a terrific guest for today, Tom Hansen by name, a PhD in mechanical engineering from Stanford. But I'm going to try a new format today, see how you like it. I'm going to use the first segment for some short takes on some of the most important stories and perhaps a longer one or two, and then bring in my guest, in this case, Tom. We'll go with a conversation that might run two more segments, and then at the bottom of the hour, in the middle of the second hour, we'll take callers. I begin with a letter to the editor in Wisconsin State Journal. Now, they long since ceased publishing letters I would submit, including about COVID, the risk of masks, the theft of the election. No matter how serious the subject, they would not publish letters from me. So I'm very surprised that the lead letter today, Friday, July 9th, reads as follows. Administration is our nation's worst. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will go down in history as the worst administration ever, worse than Jimmy Carter's. We had a secure border, energy independence, peace in the Middle East, lower income taxes, a booming economy, and Operation Warp Speed for the COVID vaccine under President Donald Trump. What do we have now? An open border crisis, with criminal human sex and drug trafficking, a canceled Keystone oil pipeline with thousands of family jobs lost, weakness to our enemies, Iran, Russia, and China, higher gas prices, inflation, riots, crime and calls to defund the police in the Democrat-run cities such as Chicago, Minneapolis, and Portland. We have a president who's too weak to lead our country and a vice president who is not capable to tackle the border crisis, and then there's Hunter Biden's laptop. David Stalowski of Verona. David, my congratulations. That was a simply wonderful letter, and to me, I'm most impressed that the Wisconsin State Journal would even publish it. Meanwhile, some short takes. We have the assassination threatening more chaos in Haiti. Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in an attack on his private residence early Wednesday, July 7th, and First Lady Martine Moïse was shot in the overnight attack and hospitalized. Now, they've arrested a good number and killed others, including one or more American Haitians. But if you want to know what this is all about, get this. Haiti is the only country in the world to not issue a single COVID-19 vaccine. They also have the lowest COVID death rates in the world. Those facts are not unrelated. But just think about it. This, I believe, is the third president of a country, including the president of Tanzania, who resisted the COVID vaccines, where he was so brilliant that he actually had the test kits used on goats, on motor oil, on fruit, and discovered, except for the motor oil, they were all coming back positive. I mean, the president of Tanzania, now it turns out he had a scientific background. What that means is everyone in the medical scientific community knows this is an enormous fraud. Meanwhile, Pfizer, trying to fatten their profit margin over an elaborate hoax, says it's time for a COVID booster. FDA and CDC, however, say not so fast. Drug maker Pfizer said Thursday it sees waning immunity from its coronavirus vaccine and says it's picking up its efforts to develop a booster dose that'll protect people from variants. Pfizer said it would soon publish data about a third dose of vaccine and submit it to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, European Medicines Agency, and other regulators. The company specified it would seek FDA emergency use authorization for a booster dose in August. But in an unusual move, the FDA has declined to go forward. Top federal agencies said Americans don't need boosters yet, said it was not up to companies alone to decide when they might be needed. Hours after Pfizer issued its statement, the FDA and Centers for Disease and Control issued a joint statement saying Americans don't need booster shots yet. Americans who have been fully vaccinated do not need a booster shot at this time, they said in a statement to CNN on Friday. The World Health Organization said, we don't know whether booster vaccines will be needed to maintain protection against COVID-19 until additional data is collected, adding limited data available on how long the protection from current doses last and whether an additional booster dose would be beneficial and for whom. Meanwhile, in their unrelenting effort to take control of the world using the coronavirus as the cover and the vaccines along with masks and what appears to be an intended food shortage to bring about mass starvation continue unabated, the Olympic host city Tokyo bans spectators amid a COVID-19 emergency. This is, to me, just embarrassingly bad. Foreign spectators had already been banned. Some events outside Tokyo will get live audiences anyway. Tokyo mustn't be the springboard for a new COVID-19 wave, as though there were a genuine bona fide COVID pandemic anyway. From the beginning, as early as at least May of last year, I've been covering the pandemic on a daily basis. Believe it or not, a daily basis. Until recently, when I began taking off Saturday and Sunday, the pandemic is a gigantic fraud. Mortality tables in Europe at the time we were being told it was spiking were flat. There was no change, no increase. A study that came out from Johns Hopkins showed that, in fact, in no age group were the death rates any higher now than they had been in the past couple of years. That means it's not happening. If there were so many who had to be incubated and all that, there'd be an increase in the sale of oxygen tanks and IV stands and drips, but that has not happened either. What we've had instead is a massive propaganda onslaught unparalleled in world history where virtually every mainstream station is constantly repeating the necessity for vaccines, which are going to do tremendous harms to human beings and other living things. More on that subsequently. Tokyo, July 8th, Reuters. The Olympics will take place without spectators in host city, Tokyo organizers said on Thursday, as a resurgent coronavirus forced Japan to declare a state of emergency in the capital that will run throughout the games. The move marked a sharp turnabout from as recently as last week, when some officials were still insisting they could organize the game safely with some fans. It all but strips the global sporting showpiece, which is due to start on July 23rd and run until August 8th, of its last vestiges of pomp and public spectacle. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga said it was essential to prevent Tokyo, where the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 was spreading, from becoming a flashpoint of new infections. My opinion, they're going to keep inventing one new variant after another new variant after another new variant, and it's all complete and total bullshit. Meanwhile, Israel, surprise, surprise, wants Biden to keep Trump's Iran sanctions, even if the nuclear deal were revived. How ridiculous is this? After all, Iran would have no reason to reduce its nuclear activity to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action limits, which we know as the Iran deal, without sanctions relief. This is coming from antiwar.com, which, by the way, is simply an excellent site. According to a report from the Times of Israel, Israeli officials recognize that the Biden administration is intent on returning to the Iran nuclear deal and are now focusing their efforts on pushing President Biden to keep Trump-era Iran sanctions in place. The strategy doesn't make much sense, considering the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA by reimposing sanctions on Iran. It's possible that the Israelis want Iran's civilian nuclear program to be under the strict limits of the deal, while the Islamic Republic is still under crippling sanctions. But Tehran would never agree to reduce its nuclear activity without significant sanctions relief. Let me say, this is very typical of the Israeli Talmudic Zionist move. They go too far. It's like how they insulted us on 9/11, where between the destruction, not collapse, of the South Tower and the North, the anchor was reporting they had a call from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine claiming responsibility, which is about as absurd as it could possibly be, and showed footage of Palestinians rejoicing, implying it was contemporaneous, when it turned out to be, as I immediately concluded, archival footage from a past religious or political event, which they just happened to have at hand, at their fingertips. This is another indication of how Israel manipulates Americans by controlling the media. Outrageous. Meanwhile, Moscow says the West would regret meddling in Russia's elections. Russia is holding legislative elections in September for the State Duma. Russia is preparing for legislative elections for a State Duma that will be held this September, and Moscow is warning against foreign interference. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Thursday said the West would regret any attempts to meddle in the upcoming election. Lavrov said it's possible Russia will see new attempts to shake, destabilize the election, to provoke protests, preferably violent protests, as the West is in the habit of doing. Notice that word habit, completely appropriate. The campaign for the non-recognition of our elections will probably follow, he said. Such plans do exist, and we know about them. It's not clear if there are real Western plans to interfere in the State Duma election, but Lavrov's fears are not unfounded. For all the accusations against Russia for interfering in U.S. elections, The U.S. is the biggest election meddler of them all. In recent years, the U.S. has rallied its allies to reject election results and put support behind opposition figures in countries that are typically allies of Russia. In Belarus, for example, the U.S. and the EU have imposed sanctions over the August 2020 presidential elections, encouraged the main opposition leader, and voiced support for demonstrators to march against Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. After Russia's State Duma election in 2011, U.S. officials questioned the legitimacy of the results. Then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the election was neither free nor fair, basing her claims on a report from an election monitor known as GOLOS, G-O-L-O-S, that received funding at the time from the U.S. government through the Agency for International Development, which, in case you are unaware, is a CIA asset. Lavrov also blasted Western countries for recent sanctions and the presence of NATO warships in the Black Sea. The U.S. is currently leading massive 32-nation naval exercises in the Black Sea, despite heightened tensions in the region, since a British warship sailed 12 miles off the coast of the Crimea. Now, regular listeners will know that I have concluded that the Dunblane massacre in Scotland, which actually killed around 16 kids and an adult, was a template for Sandy Hook, which, however, was completely fake. We know it was a two-day FEMA drill, technically a mass casualty exercise involving children. We even have the manual for the event, which I included in Appendix A of the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, where I brought together 13 experts, including six current or retired PhDs, and we established a school had been closed by 2008. It was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, damaged by a hurricane, I did not know at the time, but also a major flood had occurred in 2007, and there were no students there. It was a Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Eric Holder effort to promote gun control, where one of my contributors, Paul Preston, who has his own show, it was Agenda 21, it may be now Agenda 2030, observed that he had supervised active shooter drills in the past and was so troubled by what he saw being broadcast from Newtown that day that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, all of whom confirmed to him that it had been a drill, no students had been harmed, and it was done to promote gun control. Well, here we have a parallel case regarding the pandemic. You can find this article on my blog at jamesfetzer.org. Spanish flu. The 1918 influenza epidemic was a vaccine-caused disease. Here's a motion cart. This is by C. Johnson. Here's a motion cartoon from the earliest days of motion pictures that likely was made at the time of the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. So far, we've been unable to verify its origin, but there's no reason to think it's counterfeit. Its value will be immediately recognized, not in its rarity or as a collector's item, but its editorial commentary, stunningly contemporary to our present day. For example, one of the titles, How to Take Over the World. This is their plan. Popular sentiment 100 years ago clearly was far more aware of an agenda behind the propaganda. And as you will see in the final message, folks knew who was behind it and what the end game was. An amazing time capsule of truth you can watch on my blog. Now, here's from a marvelous piece published originally in 2009 by Barbara Peterson about a book entitled Vaccination, the Silent Killer. Very few people realize the worst epidemic ever to hit America, the Spanish influenza of 1918, was the after effect of the massive nationwide vaccine campaign. The doctors told the people that the disease was caused by germs, Viruses were not known at the time, or they would have been blamed. Germs, bacteria, and viruses, along with bacilli and a few other invisible organisms, are the scapegoats, which the doctors like to blame for the things they do not understand. If the doctor makes a wrong diagnosis and treatment and kills the patient, he can always blame it on the germs and say the patient didn't get an early diagnosis and come to him in time. If we check back in history to that 1918 flu period, we will see that it suddenly struck just after the end of World War I when our soldiers were returning home from overseas. That was the first war in which all the known vaccines were forced on all the servicemen. This mishmash of poison drugs and putrid protein, of which the vaccines were composed, caused such widespread disease and death among the soldiers that it was a common talk of the day that more of our men were being killed by medical shots than by enemy shots from guns. Thousands were invalided home or to military hospitals as hopeless wrecks before they ever saw a day of battle. The death and disease rate among the vaccinated soldiers was four times higher than among the unvaccinated civilians. But this did not stop the vaccine promoters. Vaccine has always been big business, and so it was continued doggedly. It was a shorter war than the vaccine makers had planned on, only about a year for us, so the vaccine promoters had a lot of unused spoiling vaccines left over, which they wanted to sell at good profit. So they did what they usually do. They called a meeting behind closed doors and plotted the whole sordid program. A nationwide, worldwide vaccination drive using all their vaccines and telling the people that the soldiers were coming home with many dread diseases contracted in foreign countries and that it was a patriotic duty of every man, woman, and child to get protected by rushing down to the vaccination centers and having all the shots. Most people believe their doctors and government officials and do what they say. The result was almost the entire population submitted to the shots without question. And it was only a matter of hours until people began dropping dead in agony, while many others collapsed with a disease of such virulence that no one had ever seen anything like it before. They had all the characteristics of the diseases they'd been vaccinated against, the high fever, chills, pain, cramps, diarrhea, and such of typhoid, and the pneumonia-like lung and throat congestion of diphtheria and the vomiting, headache, weakness, and misery of hepatitis from the jungle fever shots and the outbreak of sores on the skin from the smallpox shots along with paralysis from all the shots and more. 20 million died of that flu epidemic worldwide, and it seemed to be almost universal or as far away as the vaccinations reached. Greece and a few other countries, which did not accept the vaccines, were the only ones that were not hit by the flu. Doesn't that prove something? At home in the U.S., the situation was the same. The only ones who escaped the influenza were those who had refused the vaccinations. My family and I were among the few who persisted in refusing the high-pressure sales propaganda. And none of us had the flu, not even a sniffle. In spite of the fact it was all around us and in the bitter cold of winter. The doctors were baffled and claimed they didn't know what caused the strange and deadly disease, and they certainly had no cure. They should have known the underlying cause was the vaccinations, because the same thing happened to the soldiers after they had their shots at camp. The typhoid fever shots caused a worse form of the disease, which they called paratyphoid. Then they tried to suppress the symptoms of that one with a stronger vaccine, which caused a still more serious disease, which killed and disabled a great many men. The combination of all the poison vaccines fermenting together in the body caused such violent reactions they could not cope with the situation. Disaster ran rampant in the camps. Some of the military hospitals were filled with nothing but paralyzed soldiers. And they were called war casualties even before they left American soil. I talked to some of the survivors of that vaccine onslaught when they returned home after the war. And they told of the horrors, not of the war itself and battles, but of the sickness at camp. The doctors didn't want this massive vaccine disease to reflect on them, so they agreed among themselves to call it Spanish influenza. Spain was a faraway place, and some of the soldiers had been there, so the idea of calling it Spanish influenza seemed to be a good way to lay blame on someone else. The Spanish resented having us name the world scourge on them. They knew the flu didn't originate in their country. Everyone seemed to have it. The whole town was down sick and dying. The hospitals were closed because the doctors and nurses were down with the flu. Everything was closed, schools, businesses, post office, everything. No one was on the streets. It was like a ghost town. There were no doctors to care for the sick. So my parents went from house to house doing what they could to help the stricken in any way they could. They spent all day and part of the night for weeks in the sick room, came home only to eat and sleep. If germs or viruses, bacteria, or any other little organisms were the cause of that disease, they had plenty of opportunity to latch onto my parents and lay them low with a disease that had prostrated the world. But germs were not the cause of that or any other disease, so they didn't catch it. I have talked to a few other people since that time who said they escaped the 1918 flu. So I asked if they had the shots, and in every case, they said they had never believed in shots and never had any of them. Common sense tells us all these toxic vaccines all mixed up together in people could not help but cause extreme body poisoning. And poisoning of some kind or another is usually the cause of disease. Whenever a person coughs or sneezes, most people cringe, thinking germs are being spread around the air and will attack people. There's no need to fear those germs anymore, because that's not the way colds are developed. Germs can't live away from the cell's host and can't do harm anyway, even if they wanted to. They have no teeth to bite anyone, no poison pouches like snakes, mosquitoes, or bees, and do not multiply except in decomposed substances, so they're helpless to harm. Their purpose is useful, not destructive. Back after the break with my featured guest. Stand by. Look at the parallel.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, where I'm delighted to introduce my guest for today, Tom Hansen. He's a very smart, very articulate guy, earned a PhD in mechanical engineering from Stanford, which along with MIT and Caltech are the most prestigious, the most highly ranked mechanical engineering schools in the country. He's doing a lot of good work, very thoughtful guy, even added during the intro that he bought that Tom Lehrer song on vinyl when he was about 10 years old. Tom, I love it. Join the conversation.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Jim. I over the last year or so, I think one of the things that's really had my attention is the wide gap between what people know as engineers or are trained to learn as engineers versus what you actually see in the media. You know, there's always this disconnect there. And I had observed from the very beginning when people were talking about masks that the masks that were generally given are not sealed to the face. If you're putting a piece of cloth across your face or a bandana, or if you're using one of these little masks like you'd buy down at the hardware store, there was always gaps around the face and around the nose and the eyes and so on. So anybody who wore glasses or something like that, you'd immediately see in cold weather the thing is fogging your glasses. And I started wondering how these particles that we're supposed to be afraid of, these droplets that you might be coughing out or sneezing out or whatever, how these things would actually be affected by the mask in light of the fact that there are gaps in these masks. And what this led to is just some very quick calculations that just show that these masks are totally ineffective. It's very curious to me because anyone who studies mechanical engineering and goes down into the thermosciences, fluid mechanics and so on, or anyone who's an aerospace engineer for certain, as an undergraduate is going to have an introduction in one of their early fluid mechanics classes relating to Stokes flow. And Stokes flow is... it's basically named for a guy named George Stokes. If you've ever heard of the Navier-Stokes equations, it's essentially the most fundamental equations describing fluid flow. It's a set of partial differential equations, and these equations essentially describe the motion of Newtonian fluids, which most fluids are. Air, you know, when we talk about fluids, we aren't talking about just liquids like most people think, but air is a fluid. It's basically something that will it has the ability to shear and move under its own weight, kind of thing. But Stokes flow more or less relates to droplets and particles that are entrained in a flow. And when you're thinking about a people coughing out these particles containing viruses, you might ask yourself, well, how effective is a mask, and where are these particles going? I guess maybe one easy way to think about this is kind of like this: if you are if you're driving your car at very slow speed, suppose you're driving your car at 5 miles an hour, and it's, you know, it's July, it's the Midwest, and you know, you're driving through a whole bunch of bugs, right? You're never going to have any mosquitoes or little flies or anything like that, butterflies, any of these insects. They're never going to splat on your windshield, okay? And essentially, that would be like small, that would be equivalent to, you know, your particles in the flow, where the Stokes flow or the Stokes number would be very small. If you increase the speed up to 10 or 15 miles an hour, you might occasionally get a bug, but by the time you get to 30 miles an hour, you might have some bugs splatting against your windshield. And by the time you're going 60 miles an hour, it's going to be mostly splats. Most of the bugs that approach your windshield are going to splat into the windshield. And at 100 miles an hour, they're all going to be splats. And that's essentially equivalent to a large Stokes number. Essentially what it's coming down to is that as the speed of a flow increases, particles are going to have a harder time following the streamlines of the flow. The air is clearly not going through your windshield, but particles in the windshield, or particles that are entrained in the air, may, if they're small enough, flow with the air over it, or if they're large enough relative to the speed and other factors, they will not be able to follow the airflow, and they're actually just going to, you know, their inertial forces are going to cause them to splat into the windshield. So what I was trying to do is just figure out, what is the Stokes flow? What is the Stokes number in a mask, in a typical situation? And, you know, so it wasn't hard to look up. What is a typical cough velocity? What is a typical sneeze velocity? What is the particle size distribution look like for coughs? And these are things that are well known, been studied for ages. And so you can find references to all this stuff long before COVID happened. And so you don't have to be worried about whether it was influenced by, science, so-called quote science after the after the COVID so-called epidemic. And, I just ran some calculations one day. It took about 10 or 15 minutes. And what I found is that basically, for relevant particles in a cough, essentially none of the particles are going to end up in a mask. The mask isn't going to do anything. Where the flow is going to go, the particles are going to go, is out the gaps in the mask. So, I mean, if you're wearing some kind of scuba quality mask that's sealed to your face, or something like a firefighter might wear in a burning building that has elastomer soft seals that really seal to the face, that's one thing. But what I'm talking about is just these ordinary masks that everybody's wearing. And it just became self-evident, like after just a few minutes of calculation, that these masks are totally ineffective. All the particles, essentially, that are relevant to the size, I mean, a particle size distribution for, and you can find this, Journal of Aerosol Medicine from February 2007, they have a distribution in there showing, you know, this is from people who are age 30 to 50. What is the size of droplets that you see? Well, basically, it goes from approximately 10 microns down to about, I don't know, three or four microns out to about 10 microns. That's the vast majority of the particles that are being coughed out in a typical cough from people in that age. And I just do the calculations, and you can see that the Stokes numbers are really small, which means that the particles are going to go right out the mask. The mask itself does nothing to stop the particles from getting out. So the idea of wearing masks just became, to me at least, self-evident that it was completely ineffective.
Well, Tom, not only are you 100% correct, plus that the virus is far too tiny to be filtered out by the mask by a factor of at least three, possibly even greater, but the masks do tremendous damage to those who are wearing by recycling oxygen-depleted air, which actually has the effect of killing brain cells. And as you know, of course, brain cells, unlike skin cells, for example, do not regenerate. So they bring about permanent brain damage. They cause stress on the cardiovascular system for lack of oxygen. When I've seen, you know, photographs, pictures, videos of girls playing soccer wearing masks, it's just been terribly affecting, because this is so outrageous. This is so harmful, especially to children. On my blog at jamesfetzer.org, You can find 8 or 10 different studies about the use of masks, which are very thoroughly, copiously documented, some even from the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, the most prestigious medical scientific organization in America, explaining that masks are not good, that they're not recommended, they shouldn't be used. We even have studies there showing they're not even useful in an operating room setting, Tom. I mean, it's just embarrassingly bad. And of course, Anthony Fauci, whom I predict will go down as the greatest mass murderer in history, responsible for more deaths than all our foreign enemies, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Emperor Hirohito combined, began initially saying masks weren't necessary, but then reversed course. And of course, he's also been opposed to HCQ, which, miracle of miracles, the American Medical Association has only now reversed itself and said, yes, hydroxychloroquine can be used to deal with COVID, when Fauci himself knew from a study way back in 2005 that it was actually a miracle drug for anything like this that would prevent it if you didn't have it and cure it if you did. This guy is such a monster. I love everything you're saying here because it gives technical, scientific, engineering perspective proof that this whole mask business is a complete and total sham. I'm delighted.
Well, thanks. The thing about coughing out individual virus, I know that people have talked about this in terms of, you know, oh, well, the pore size in these masks is much greater than the size of the virus particle. And I'm sure that's, I have no doubt that that's actually true. But the thing is that we aren't really coughing out individual viruses. I think if people are coughing something and there's a particle in the flow, it's really just like spit in your mouth or spit in your throat, those kind of things, saliva that's being transferred into the fluid flow. And so these droplets are clearly much, much, much larger than the size of the pore. So basically viruses would be entrained in the droplets themselves, you wouldn't be coughing out individual viruses. And so certainly with the droplets, the droplet size is such that they would certainly be captured in the mesh of a mask. But the point here is that they don't, the masks themselves, will not necessarily even see the droplets, because in exactly the same way that a butterfly at relatively low speed will not splat against your windshield in your car, a droplet in your cough that is going towards this mask will, if it's small enough, it will also not smash into the mask surface. It will actually just take the path of low resistance, which is the gaps around the mask, and go right out. Certainly, I'm sure that you saw videos and lots of people saw videos that were, you know, came out in the last year where people were wearing masks and then they were vaping. And then they would just show exactly how the flow, a very small portion of it may go through the mask, and then a huge fraction of it comes out through the gaps around the mask. And this also relates to this idea where we were being told that more layers makes you safer, which I immediately thought was ludicrous. If two layers of mask is better than one, and three is better than two, then, I mean, you might just do the thought experiment. Then why? What about 100 layers of mask? You know, what about 1,000 layers of mask? If the mask is impenetrable, doesn't that mean that it's going to capture every viral particle? And I mean, to somebody who doesn't think very much, the answer may seem like yes, but the obvious answer actually is no. If you have a mask, let's imagine that you have a mask that's made out of pantyhose or something like that, that's essentially very, very porous. Well, then obviously there's very little resistance to the flow, and things will go back, you know, you'll breathe through that mask very easily. If it's made out of cheesecloth or something like that, very low resistance, most of the flow will go right back and forth through this low resistance path. But as you increase the resistance, as you start putting on one layer after another, as you make tighter woven cloth, if you put a second layer or in a third layer, you are doubling and tripling the resistance to flow through that pathway, which makes the gaps even, you know, by comparison, it's a much lower resistance to flow pathway for the fluid to travel. And so the more layers of mask you wear, essentially, if you started wearing a mask that had 100 layers, essentially there's going to be zero flow through the mask, and 100% of the flow is going to be through the gaps around the mask, or else you're going to suffocate. It's just that simple.
Oh, Tom, I think you've nailed it right on the head. And it's just wonderful to have expertise like yours. But let me ask this question. There have to be, you know, literally thousands of engineers who perceive the same problem that you've so deftly outlined here who aren't speaking out. I mean, I'm reminded of what happened on 9/11 when we were told that the Twin Towers collapsed, when in fact they're blowing apart in every direction from the top down. They're being converted into millions of yards of very fine dust. They're doing anything but collapse, but no one spoke out about it. What's going on there, Tom? Why aren't more experts like yourself speaking out and calling this fraud by name?
That's a question I struggle with a lot, because I think that it cuts across lots of professional fields. It's not just engineers, but it's lawyers, it's doctors, it's all sorts of people who they should know better. And one of the things I struggle with is the idea that essentially our education selects for obedience. And the higher the education, more or less, it really translates for most people into the greater the obedience. I mean, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get through, you know, your undergraduate. And if you want to get a master's and a PhD, you're going to have to do that. And so everybody, you know, you learn to read between the lines. There's no handbook of how to make it in academics, but everybody knows where you can't tread, right? It means that you are reading between the lines. Everybody knows that you're not going to make it far if you rock the boat the wrong way. I think this is your question addresses why you see academic, professors and so on, people who are, you know, high up in the military and so on. They tend to speak out mostly at the ends of their careers or when they're retired, if they speak out at all. You know, it's obvious that there can be a very, very significant cost to your career if you start going against the mainstream views about almost everything.
But it's so disappointing. My God, Tom. I mean, you know, the nation is suffering because, experts are unwilling to speak out in order to protect themselves. I question, you know, the moral integrity and courage. But of course, that's exactly the problem. There is no moral integrity or courage involved here. It's just stunningly bad, in my opinion. Stunningly bad.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, I feel like the value of education or, you know, university education. I mean, when I was going, of course, it was, you know, you're just kind of dealing with political correctness, which seems like very lightweight compared to what's going on now. I mean, with wokeness and critical race theory. But I mean, when you look at this stuff, you can see that universities are just completely destroying their value. They're undermining everything that would make them value in the first place. You have your massive corporations, which are advertising in ways that insult their customer base, and they don't seem to care. And I think those same kind of corporations are, you know, when you recognize that, you know, BlackRock owns 5 or 10% of every corporation on the planet, or every significant corporation in the United States, for instance, and certainly many others around the world, it doesn't particularly matter if they insult you through one company, because you're going to end up buying through the system anyway. Just for you to survive relies on supporting these corporations. So it doesn't matter that they're insulting you. And those corporations can hire all the people who they want who really don't know anything. But my sense is that smaller businesses, the ones that actually have to get things done in order to survive, the ones who don't have an easy pathway to success, those businesses absolutely rely on having people who are competent and able to do their jobs with a great deal of professionalism and competency. Engineering basically, in my view, is basically just a vo-tech it's a vo-tech education for people who can do math. I mean, let's not say that, you know, people who go out and study the classics or something like that and understand history, well, that's what is it all about? You're trying to understand human nature. But engineering is mostly it's like being an auto mechanic or a carpenter or something like that. It just has it's a training type thing. So you're not, you know, you say like you're an educated person, but you, it's not so much like that. We just have to recognize that there's you know, you're supposed to take an oath at the end of your engineering undergraduate, basically saying like, listen, I promise not to do things that are unethical. And usually that means kind of like in an active way, but it doesn't address the passive way where you're not speaking up about things when you know better. I think that's kind of like, you agree that I'm not going to design intentionally a bridge that's going to fail. But on the other hand, it doesn't speak so much to the idea that, well, I know somebody a few hundred miles away is designing a bridge that's going to fail, and that you have to speak up about that. It's more like it's on you. And I think, like, you know, we could really benefit from having people with, you know, in an environment that is a little bit more open. Everybody loves to talk about diversity and so on, but there sure isn't very much diversity of thought these days, because if you speak out very far, you're going to find yourself at the wrong end of the stick.
Well, let me just add, I don't hold engineers as a primary responsibility here, but physicians who subscribe to the Hippocratic Oath, which says, first, I shall do no harm, are nevertheless recommending these vaccines, promoting the wearing of masks. They are, in my judgment, grossly violating their most solemn obligation to their patients and seemingly doing it with utter impunity and even a clear conscience. I mean, to me, this is dumbfounding, Tom, dumbfounding.
You know, that's a really interesting point. You know, I kind of make a distinction between science and quote science. You know, like science is more or less people seem to, there's a lot of ignorance in the population about what science is. And for most people, it seems to be mostly just a cult of the white lab coat. You know, it's essentially if there's somebody who looks like a scientist, then you're just supposed to believe. And so it's really not very different from religion. Whereas, you know, if they had a little bit more hands-on experience with this, you just find out that science is basically a method of, you know, generating hypotheses, testing them, and evaluating the data to generate new hypotheses. And like anybody who's thought about this or works in science always recognizes that there is no end of the road, that the science is never settled. All these kind of things are just absolute absurdities. And yet these kind of ideas are promoted out there, like, well, like that we know global warming is happening, and you know, there's no more research. We don't need to do any more research on determining whether global warming is happening, but more research is still needed, because, you know, we definitely need to fund our pensions and make sure that we receive our salaries for the next few years until I retire, or something along those lines, right? So it's just, I really do find that science, in light of the current context, I do believe that it is truly failing. You know, if you're looking for a place where science is honest, I would say the number one place I can say with like firsthand experience is semiconductor. Semiconductor research in that kind of science is absolutely honest. And you know why? Because it has to work. And you know why also? It's because it's observable by its customers if it does what, you know, if it does what it's said to say. Whereas medicine is just all shades of gray. You have all sorts of hypotheses that are excluded from consideration. And, you know, a lot of medical research is essentially epidemiological, where you don't have world A versus world B, and people are constantly confusing correlation and causation. They're just looking for patterns. They don't have any control over exposures, and you never really know what isn't being investigated. The unknown unknowns can maybe be the main cause of all sorts of things that we really don't know what's going on. I just see people need to open their minds to the possibility that there are that quote science is absolutely a institution that is working against their interest.
Well, what you're really talking about is science is presented to the public by spokespersons who tend to be phonies or frauds. I mean, real science, which I know rather extensively from my background as a PhD in the history of science and the philosophy of science, on which I publish extensively. I mean, real science is our most reliable method for discovering knowledge, for learning the way the world works, especially the laws of nature, physics, chemistry, biology, physiology, so on, which cannot be violated and cannot be changed. But we have a lot of flakes who are public relations salesmen, such as those who pose as doctors and come on to encourage you to fatten the profit margin for Moderna and Pfizer, and where they have no conscience whatsoever, Tom. I find it embarrassing every time I see one of these flakes on MSNBC, which my wife loves to watch, or CNN, less often on Fox, of course, where Tucker in particular has been doing a good job of exposing a whole lot of the fraud behind the coronavirus and calling out Anthony Fauci in a way that no other person on television today has been doing, but it's all profoundly disturbing. So we have to distinguish between, roughly speaking, the quacks, the pseudoscience, and the real serious scientists. These are completely different animals, species, beings. It's really stunning to me to see this abuse of science in the public eye taking place, Tom.
Oh, I agree completely. When you think about it really is kind of like people who have experience doing something have a very different sensibility than people who only purchase products. I mean, like, for instance, if you ever, you know, if you ever make your own furniture, or if you've ever sewn your own clothes, or if you've ever, roofed your own house or something along those lines, if you do things firsthand, you obviously gain an understanding of, like, what is quality? What am I looking for? What are the underlying realities of this of this problem, and it puts you in a position where you can evaluate things in a very meaningful way, and you can tell the difference between good work and bad work. Unfortunately, science, being such a broad, you know, a word that captures so many different things, and you know, the amount of knowledge that's out there being so vast that it's obviously completely out of the question that anybody can begin to even scratch the surface these days, except in a very it's going to be a very superficial understanding when besides like a few fields that you might become very expert in.
Tom, you're going to have to hold that thought. We're up against a break. I'm delighted to have here as my guest Tom Hansen, PhD in mechanical engineering from Stanford, a man of very broad knowledge, very articulate, incisive. I'm just delighted to have him here on The Raw Deal with me today. We'll be right back.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years.
to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, with my very special guest today, Tom Hansen. Here's an example of a story that's going to be replicated, not just thousands, but tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of times across the country. 13-year-old dies in his sleep 3 days after receiving second dose of Pfizer vaccine. This is from Mike Adams, Natural News. A 13-year-old boy from Michigan died in his sleep just 3 days after receiving his second dose of the experimental Wuhan coronavirus vaccine. Jacob Kleinick received his second dose of the Pfizer vaccine at Walgreens in Zilwaukee, Saginaw County, Central Michigan, on June 13th, according to Tammy Burgess, Kleinick's aunt. The only side effects he initially experienced were fatigue and fever, which are supposedly normal. But on June 15th, Kleinick started complaining about a stomach ache. Burgess said the family considered the stomach ache not to be severe enough to warrant medical attention. Kleinick died sometime after he went to bed. He passed away in the middle of the night at home, said Burgess. Kleinick, who lived in Zilwaukee, had just completed eighth grade. According to his family, he was very healthy, had no known underlying medical conditions. He was looking forward to starting classes in the fall as a high school freshman at Carrollton High School. His family remembers him as a kind boy who loved to go camping with his father and was brave enough to stand up to bullies in school. Burgess said he was even voted most likely to become president of the United States. He loved to tell corny dad jokes and always had plenty of them to hand out, said Burgess. He found the funny side of every situation. And the world will be a little less fun without him in it. In my opinion, Tom, there's nothing funny about the situation we're in here now, and that the physicians of the nation are abdicating their responsibility in violation of the Hippocratic Oath to me is disgusting beyond belief.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, when you look at the when you look at a situation like this, where parents are being encouraged to give their to put, you know, put their kids into a medical system, encouraged to give them a medication, a shot that has never had any long-term tests, anything like this, and essentially compelling them through just social pressure, telling them that unless you do this, you're not a good person. You know, let's be honest, most people are highly susceptible to social pressure. There's very few people who kind of just, you know, look at the world and say, I don't care what other people think. I'm going to do whatever I think I'm supposed to do. Vast majority of people are extremely susceptible to what the masses are doing. And then to think that basically you end up sacrificing a lovely young child on the altar of quote science, it's absolutely maddening.
Oh yeah, it's infuriating. Now let me go back to 9/11. Did it trouble you at the time what you saw being reported? I mean, look, I was just lying in bed drinking a cup of coffee, reading a paper, when our daughter, then living in Bradenton, Florida, called and said, turn on the TV. We turned on the TV. The South Tower was smoking. The North Tower was smoking. I looked at this thing, and as we watched these events take place, when the two buildings were destroyed, and I watched it, I said, this is preposterous. I knew immediately it wasn't even physically possible that what we were being told was happening, or even that it was consistent with what we saw with our own eyes, because we were being told the buildings had collapsed, but they weren't collapsing. I mean, it was just absolutely stunning. I mean, I had such a clear thought at the time, Tom, as this was going on, that I thought to myself, but I'll never be in a position to do anything about it. Well, ironically, it would turn out that in December 2005, I find myself in the midst of a discussion group of about two dozen experts from around the world, and I recognize that founding a loose affiliation or a society might be a good way to promote research. And I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth. It took off like a rocket. It made a real impact at the time. In fact, we were so successful that just as Amazon had to ban my book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, there were figures within my organization who had to sabotage the organization from within. So that just as I was in Greece, where I'd been invited by the leading muckraker in Greece to come on a televised program originally scheduled for 3 hours and extended to 3.5 with a panel of 12 about 9/11, where the station had done such a brilliant job of putting together a dozen or 15 video clips from 9/11. They told me going in that only two or three will usually ask during a show, and I said, not tonight. And I was right. Every one of the 12 asked questions. But it was a complete sensation. It was broadcast worldwide by satellite, 3.5 hours, at the very time these others were sabotaging scholars at home. I mean, it was just disgusting. But I think that's exactly what happened. So that now I have published on the Boston bombing, on Orlando and Dallas, on Charlottesville, on Parkland, even on the moon landing, though I believe that book was banned because of the discussion of disputing the official narrative of the Holocaust, where you can find some of the best essays ever published about that issue in that book. Amazon has banned 5 more. I mean, Tom, what's become of America? When I was growing up, you could say anything you wanted because we actually had what was known as freedom of speech. And in my opinion, it doesn't mean anything to be an American if you can't be outspoken in your criticism of our government. So where has our nation gone?
Well, I'm not too impressed these days. I mean, I feel pretty similarly about this. I mean, all these different topics, what it blows a guy's mind to think that really, when you look at the media, what I'm always shocked by is how can people just continue to believe one thing after another after they are aware that they've been lied to about, you know, things going long back in history. But I mean, there's really significant events, ones that are really obvious, you know, say Kennedy, Gulf of Tonkin, these kind of things, or, you know, moving up in history, you come up to 9/11 and so on. How is it that when you have a media that absolutely consistently viciously lies to you that you will take anything else that they say seriously at face value, especially when, if you look at it, there's a pattern to the behavior and it's obvious that they are trying to form the society into something that is absolutely anti-American. Getting right at exactly what you're talking about, this idea that you should have the absolute right to speak your mind without any, it's not to say that you won't have consequences in your life of friends or business or anything like that, but certainly shouldn't be facing any kind of censorship. That's outrageous.
I couldn't agree more, just outrageous. But let me ask, returning to 9/11, did you have similar thoughts? I mean, I'm sure you were glued to the television just as much as was I. I mean, it seemed to me every engineer in the country had to know we were being sold a mess of pottage, that this made no sense whatsoever from the point of view of physics and engineering. Did anything like that occur to you at the time? Have you been troubled that professional engineers, persons with a scientific and technical background to make these evaluations, have not spoken out?
Well, okay, so I'll put it this way. I was absolutely ignorant about 9/11 until around 2008. Obviously I watched the videos just like everybody else, but when I heard the talk of conspiracy theory and that kind of stuff, it's not to say that I wasn't open to these kind of things in other aspects of my life, but that one, I didn't go down that hole until I was actually living in Germany, where it was shocking to me that there was a completely different way that the subject was talked about, where it was kind of almost just openly acknowledged as being an inside job. I mean, here in the United States, I mean, you'd hear that kind of stuff, but it would always be in the context of conspiracy theory. Whereas in Germany, when I lived there, it was exactly the opposite, where it was just like, oh, of course. I mean, it's obvious that it was an inside job. And I believe the thing that really opened my mind to this, and, you know, being an engineer, it came down to watching a video that was done by a, if I recall, it was a guy named like David Chandler, I remember, if I recall, a video where he analyzed the fall of Building 7 frame by frame and demonstrated that the rate of acceleration of that building was equivalent to free fall within the error of, within the error bars of the measurements. And it was, to me, that was where, look, I don't know who did it or how it was accomplished. I don't have theories. I haven't gotten into that aspect deeply. But when I saw something so simple that, okay, the roof of this building is accelerating at the rate of free fall, that immediately means that there is no structural beams being deformed in order, because otherwise, you know, you only have so much gravitational potential energy for things to fall. And if the building is having to deform beams as it falls, well, obviously it can't fall at the same rate as something that is seeing no resistance at all. And so it was self-evident from that point on that there was something very, very nefarious going on. And that's when I realized, that the whole, if that happened in Building 7, then obviously everything else that we were being told about that was a complete lie.
Yes. Yes. David Chandler's been good on Building 7, but very bad on the Twin Towers. In fact, it turns out that the 9/11 truth community is saddled with limited hangouts, which is true of architects and engineers and of Judy Wood and her Do group, where architects and engineers won't even talk about who was responsible and why, which means, Tom, for all of their efforts to expose whatever, without the American people having a context within which to embed it, it's all to them just technical gibberish, because it doesn't fit into a storyline which they refuse to provide. Judy Wood is just the same. They both basically insist that you have to know how it was done before you can even address who is responsible and why, which is, of course, frankly absurd. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. I mean, this is just insultingly bad. And where they both give a hopelessly inadequate account of how it was done, where, believe it or not, to this very day, architects and engineers continue to promote the nanothermite theory, which T. Mark Hightower and I blew apart with three articles back in 2011, where we explained, Mark being himself a chemical engineer, that based upon a survey of the literature, it's a law of material science. If for an explosive to destroy a material, it must have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material, that the speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second in steel, 6,100 meters per second, but the highest attributed detonation velocity for nanothermite is only 895 meters per second, which means you can't get there from there. Indeed, it's such a feeble explosive that Niels Harrit, who's a professor of chemistry emeritus from the University of Copenhagen, calculated that in order to destroy a twin tower would have required 29,000 metric tons of nanothermite. Tom, I mean, that's enough to gag on. How they can they expect anyone to take such a preposterous theory seriously?
Yeah, well, this goes to something I think about again, and it cuts across so many aspects of our lives. You know, a guy who's a Nobel Prize winner in physics or chemistry is not going to necessarily be aware of what's happening in medicine at all, you know, and vice versa. You know, even though these all fall under the rubric of science, it doesn't mean that various scientists can actually even speak the language or understand what other people in, you know, under who are also, quote, scientists are doing. And what you're talking about there, to me, I being an engineer and, you know, this is the hammer I get to hit everything with, I oftentimes just come back to thermodynamics and first law conservation of energy type considerations. And when you look at 9/11, and you know, I obviously wasn't there, and I don't have you know, firsthand experience with any of this kind of stuff. But you start looking at, well, what happened to the concrete? Does it take energy to take a rock and pulverize it? Well, absolutely it does. I mean, anybody who's ever worked with wood knows, like, making sawdust, if you're using a handsaw or something like that, takes an awful lot of energy just to make a small kerf out of there. So how in the world can you convert concrete into concrete dust? I mean, there's a tremendous amount of energy that is required to do that. I mean, every time that you increase the surface area equals more energy that was required to split the boundaries between the particles. And so, I mean, I look at that kind of stuff and say, listen, it's so simple. It's so obvious that if you apply these concepts, which anybody who goes through high school physics or something like that should be able to see, listen, you're going to learn about a free fall acceleration, and you are going to learn about conservation of energy. How come you can't take those things that you learned in high school and apply them to the situation that you can see right on your in front of you on your television and start asking some questions rather than taking these, quote, scientists, these people who are obviously just intentionally misinforming, you know, misdirection agents, and pushing you off into rabbit holes that go nowhere. It's these kind of things. I really don't believe that the world is such a, you know, when it comes right down to it, a lot of things can be disproven with extremely simple methods. And I mean, right here, you just go to first law of thermodynamics, you know, conservation of energy 101. Apply that kind of stuff. Look at how much concrete dust there was. Compare it with the gravitational potential of the buildings. Is there enough energy in the falling of the buildings to pulverize that much concrete? The analysis I did years and years ago said not even close.
Yeah, not even close. I mean, it's absurd, frankly. It's simply absurd to think that the building, number one, could have collapsed, because if you study their design, I had a retired high school math, physics, chemistry teacher calculate. He found for every unit of downward pressure, there were 199 units of upward pressure. I mean, it wasn't even possible. It's like the planes entering the buildings, the North and the South Tower. The North Tower Flight 11 was intersecting seven different flights, 175, with the South Tower, eight different floors. Each floor consisted of a steel truss filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, connected at one end to the massive core columns, at the other to the external steel support columns, which were quite formidable in and of themselves because the buildings were 208 feet on a side. Each floor represented an acre of concrete on a steel truss. And the idea to even imagine that this aluminum airplane, I mean, this is analogous to throwing an empty beer can against a stone wall. No matter how hard you throw it, it's not going to penetrate the stone wall, and the plane could not penetrate the building, which is why they had to find an elaborate way to fake it. But I should think, Tom, equally, that any person with any degree of understanding of physics would recognize that this aircraft, even if it weighed, say, 125 tons, isn't going to penetrate a 500,000-ton steel and concrete building intersecting at 7 floors or 8 floors. It would have crumbled external to the building, body, seats, luggage, wing, tail falling to the ground. Engines, which are practically indestructible, might have penetrated, but not the rest of the plane. And yet we have photographs beneath the facades of both buildings that show there's no body, seats, luggage, no debris from the aircraft. The whole thing was totally fraudulent. I mean, it was a very clever deception using Hollywood-style special effects. Tom, I'm just dumbfounded that it should take so long. You know, I mean, I've been making these points for quite a long time now, but there's very little response out there in the scientific or academic community. For most academicians don't want to get close to 9/11 or JFK, much less the Holocaust with a 10-foot pole. I mean, they are so intimidated. They are so fearful. They are peeing in their pants. I mean, it's unbelievable how bad things are in the institutions of higher learning as they are known in the United States of America today.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you just think about how intimidating, you know, if you go to a park or someplace like that where they don't want cars or motorcycles or something like that to drive on a footpath or something, they put up a couple of beams or a little tube full of concrete or something like that. And you can kind of intuitively see that if that thing's 6 inches in diameter, your car is going to be destroyed if you decide to crash into that thing at 50 miles an hour, you know, trying to break it down. You're gonna total your vehicle for sure. But I mean, like, I don't think people actually have like a very clear understanding of how big and or strong these I-beams and tubular structures actually are that made up the towers. I mean, when you're talking about you know, you get on an airplane and notice as you go through the door, what is the thickness of that aluminum shell that the Boeing or Airbus is actually made out of? Well, you know, it's kind of a 3/8 of an inch sort of a thickness, something like that. And it's made out of aluminum versus, you know, we're talking about steel structures here with many multiple columns where the thickness of these beams is oftentimes, you know, greater than 2 inches of steel. And I mean, lots of them. It's just like, it's ludicrous. Aluminum is basically 1/3 of steel. It's 1/3 the density, 1/3 the strength. And well, not, it depends like what kind of alloys you're talking here, but basically high strength steel is going to go a lot farther than aluminum. Of course, the A36 type stuff that buildings are made out of is relatively low yield strength, but still you're talking about, I just see no way that you're going to be crashing aluminum through buildings. I mean, absolutely what you said, the engine cores are made out of all sorts of, you know, high temperature, super alloy type stuff, high nickel alloys in the turbine sections and so on. And of course those things could certainly penetrate, but yeah, the idea of the aluminum structure just going right through the building and potentially coming out the other side, that is absurd.
Absurd indeed. Yes, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you'd think buildings ought to be made out of aluminum rather than steel if this thesis, you know, of the building, of the plane just crashing through this massive steel-reinforced concrete structure. Were true. I mean, it's ridiculous on its face. As you say, there are typically very simple explanations that serve as refutations. I think the analogy of throwing a beer can at a stone wall is just perfect, exactly in this case, because the plane is like a flying beer can, and it's going into this massive, the equivalent of a stone wall. Indeed, if anything, because of its steel reinforcement is even more formidable than a stone wall. I mean, Tom, give me a break.
Hey, well, it comes down to basic ignorance. You know, if you had more people who were, you know, kind of engaging the world in a real way and, you know, like you're not just computer jockeys or something like that, but you're out there making things. I think this is actually one of the reasons why you kind of find that you're less educated. You know, let's just put it, you know, when I say less educated, what I really mean is less schooled people are oftentimes more intuitively correct about a lot of things that are going on in the world. You know, your folks who are shopping at Walmart to buy their groceries are oftentimes a little bit more dialed in about like COVID than the folks who are shopping at Whole Foods. I mean, it's just it's a giant generalization, but really, your blue collar kind of people are working with their hands, doing things out in the real world, have a sense of what is physically possible, whereas other people are just susceptible to whatever the science or whatever the so-called you know, authorities are telling you. And I mean, when you look at these kind of situations, if you have experience in the real world, you're going to say, yeah, a beer can into a stone wall, the beer can is not going to penetrate the stone wall. It's certainly not going to come out the other side of the stone.
Right. Right? I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Let me say, as advertised, we're going to take callers during the final segment of the show. We've had one patiently standing by already, Bruce from Texas. We'll bring him in after the break. The number for anyone who may have misplaced it, 540-352-4452. 540-352-4452 to speak to Tom and me about the issues we've been discussing or others that may be on your mind. As you can see, my guest is quite a brilliant guy who's got a profound understanding of many issues of greatest importance to the American people today. Tom, I can't tell you how delighted I am to have you here with me. This is just wonderful. I think you're a natural for talk radio and articulating your view in clear language that's easily understood. I'm just baffled that the professional communities across the board, whether it's the medical or the engineering or the physical scientists, haven't spoken out with a loud voice to denounce the theories we've been sold about 9/11 or now today about the COVID pandemic, because it's all easily falsified. It's not tough. It's not a great challenge. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to refute the claim of this aluminum plane just passing its whole length into the building, a massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete building, and the same number of frames it passes through its own length in air, which is preposterous unless a massive 5,000-ton steel and concrete building poses no more resistance to the trajectory of an aircraft in flight than air. I mean, how dumb is that? In this COVID, you can't have these pandemics if you don't have an increase in mortality, which has not occurred. We'll be right back with Tom Hansen. Thanks for being here.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Yeah.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it, that the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, that Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm simply delighted to have Tom Hansen here with me. As mentioned, he has a PhD from Stanford in mechanical engineering. We have Bruce from Texas standing by. Bruce.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
Okay, great. Hopefully my sound quality is okay.
Yep, you're fine.
Great. Yeah, I agree with you, John. Jim, that this is a great guest. I want to put a few points out, and then I'm going to have to just put it on hold and let you all respond. First of all, at the Frisk Kills landfill, where they moved all the steel rubble and such, immediately following 9/11, you could also see that there are giant girders that formed the foundation for the elevator shafts that were superheated instantaneously. They had flash rust all along the sides of them. And due to the weight of the material coming down at the same time that the metal was superheated, they were bent into pretzels and all sorts of bizarre shapes. And so we also need to figure out not only what can disassociate such massive amounts of concrete into fine powder, scatter firefighters for blocks around, vaporize people, but also what can turn steel girders into noodles, you know, instantaneously? I think there's really only one answer to that. And if you also remember, Jim, that there was a doctor, or he wasn't a doctor, but he was a demolitions expert, Danny Joenko in Poland, who was being interviewed by 9/11 truth people. And he was adamant about Building 7 being a controlled demolition. And he died mysteriously or in a car accident somehow. Also, Barry Jennings, the witness there in Building 7, who stepped on dead people and witnessed explosions. It's a carrot and a stick situation. I think this is why so many academics are afraid to speak out. It's also career suicide. And I put in the chat a link to a video. It's still on YouTube, amazingly. It's a Dr. John Gross of NIST. He's a perfect example of intellectual dishonesty in the scientific community. He's given a presentation at the University of Texas in around 2008 on the 9/11 event. And at the very end, someone asked him, well, what about the pools of molten steel in the basement? And he starts twisting his glasses. He takes a drink of water. You can tell he's nervous. And he says, well, have you seen them? And of course, that's a tar baby question. Yeah, I mean, that's a red herring. And the questioner says, no, but there are witnesses. And then the video cuts to firefighters describing pools of molten steel like a foundry in the basement. And then other testimony of boots burning, of dogs catching their feet on fire for weeks and months later. So, yeah, there's a definite problem. It's the destruction of the academic community and the scientific community, the corruption of it. It's really threatening our society as a whole, and that's the extent of my comments for today. I'm going to go ahead and put it on hold, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Well, thanks, Bruce. That's a lot of good stuff. I think you answered your own question about being surprised that this presentation was still up on YouTube when you said he was being dishonest about what he had to say about 9/11. That's the reason it's up on YouTube. If he'd been honest, like Danny Jawenko was honest or Barry Jennings was honest, they wouldn't allow it to be on YouTube. I've had hundreds of videos taken down that I presented about 9/11 and the Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing and all that on YouTube. What we know, of course, is that the U.S. Geological Survey studied dust samples from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Barium, strontium, lithium, lanthanum, tritium, some of which only exist in radioactive forms. We've had an outbreak of medical maladies, leukemia, multiple myeloma, esophageal, pancreatic cancer, of the kind we saw after the Chernobyl nuclear reactor meltdown in Russia. And the estimate is as many as 70,000 first responders and local residents have suffered the debilitating effects from exposure to radiation. I recently did a three-parter on a new program with Scott Bennett, who's a former Army Intel and PSYOPs officer, on his show, Great Awakening, on AmericaMediaPeriscope.net. About the 9/11 attacks. It occurred in three parts on the 30th of June, on the 2nd of July. The very first was on the 25th of June. So it's the 25th of June, the 30th of June, and the 2nd of July. And on the 3rd, we were joined by Joe Olson, who has discussed the nuclear demolition of the Twin Towers. There's actually a very interesting exchange that took place on the UNS Review, an article of mine entitled What's Wrong with Conspiracy Theories, which drew 950 comments, many attempts to try to salvage the official narrative from critiques I was offering. You can find links to a number of my presentations about 9/11. Meanwhile, Tom, would you like to weigh in on what we've heard from Bruce?
Yeah, I think Bruce makes really nice points. To me, I guess the simple phrase is science is captured. You can do this little thought experiment and ask yourself this question. What would science look like if the penalties for investigating alternative explanations disappeared? You know, if you think about that, do you really think that there is just one answer to all these things and it just appears out of nowhere? I mean, when you're talking about something that's new, I assure you, there are always going to be multiple competing theories actively being investigated in real science. There's always going to be different ways of looking at it. And you're going to, if you go to scientific meetings, you find that people have strong disagreements about oftentimes like what seems like minutia, and it probably is to, you know, most of us in our lives. But the thing is, it's like to them, it's a big deal. Like, listen, we are really trying to understand what we see. We are collecting data. We're creating hypotheses. We're making tests to see where things are going. And you have a real active discussion with other people at different institutions, corporations and universities and so on, government labs where this happens. On the other hand, when you look at certain kinds of things which are clearly intended to be psyops or something to that effect, like 9/11 or COVID or something like that, you'll notice that there is exactly one and one only explanation that is allowed to be investigated, the COVID. What is the only answer? The answer is the vaccine. You must get the vaccine. We can't do anything about anything until we get the vaccine. All possibilities of, oh, maybe you can eat something different. Maybe there are other drugs that will do this. Maybe if you're overweight, you should stop, you know, do something about that. Get more sunshine. Never do they discuss any of this kind of stuff as being a plausible way to treat treat the situation. It's only, we just have to wait until we can take this shot. And with 9/11, I mean, from the first day, it is Al-Qaeda, and we have, and it's just, it's clear that basically the airline, the airplanes ran into buildings and they fell down, and that's all you're going to hear about it. There is no other explanation. I can tell you that in my kind of looking around at things, that the cost of speaking out is so high that people are willing to bend to that. You know, it's like, look, an academic career is a very prestigious thing. A lot of people who become academics, they're absolutely among the highest IQ people on the planet. I don't doubt that. But on the other hand, they are able to see for themselves that their career is going to be toast if they don't stick, you know, stay within certain, you know, they got to stay inside the fences, because if you don't, your career is going to be over. Tenure doesn't seem to mean much of anything these days. You know, and so if you just think, hey, if you had the possibility of looking for different explanations, because there weren't the penalties on this, I bet you instantly there would be a complete sea change in terms of how science is viewed in this country.
I think those are great points, Tom. And academicians, most of all, don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want a student who asks them a question they can't answer. They don't want to be put on the spot with any issue that reveals their ignorance. So they tend to be very restrained in getting involved in any issue that's controversial with the public, especially, even though faculty, as all faculty know, are like independent contractors. They don't speak for the university. Only the administration speaks for the university. And yet they have to go out of their way. For example, on my own academic curriculum vitae blog, the university felt it had to add a disclaimer that my views don't represent those of the university, which no one would have ever thought were the case anyway, unless I'd been a dean or a provost or a president, which of course I would never become. I'm much too outspoken and dedicated to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We have another caller here. We have my dear friend Saul in Colorado. Saul, join the conversation with Tom Hansen.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Jim. There's something I've meant to bring to your attention about the videotaped falling of the buildings on 9/11. Have you noticed that there's no shadows of anything? The light is exactly the same. Well, that doesn't happen in real life. There are shadows. You see other things. You see shadows from other objects around. And this is from a guy who doesn't see particularly well. And if Sal, who doesn't have as good of eyesight as many other people, has figured this out, how come more people besides you gentlemen haven't figured this out? It's just because it's that cookie cutter narrative where everything's exactly the same. You probably even have to use the same words in the exact same order at this point in time. Play the game.
Pretty close, Saul. I think that's pretty near exactly right. Tom, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I haven't really gone down the rabbit hole of, analyzing the videography and that kind of stuff. I really don't know. I mean, like, when you see, like, there are certainly techniques that could be used to do things that maybe weren't sophisticated enough in 2001 to pull things off maybe the way they'd be able to now. Or maybe it's just that, you know, it creates a level of sophistication that, you know, all of a sudden it provides ways of analyzing things after the fact, which would be too easy basically could create problems for the instigators of the event later on. It doesn't surprise me that they might try to simplify matters, but I frankly don't feel very expert on that and probably can't speak to it in an intelligent way.
Sure. That's not a problem. I think Sal was alluding to the approach of Flight 175, that the plane isn't casting any shadows. Mm-hmm. There turned out to be good reasons for that, because it turns out to have been a hologram. Anyone who wants to look at the bidding on this, I discussed it on AmericanMediaPeriscope.net with Scott Bennett so recently. You can also find a nice overview about 9/11, who was responsible and why on BitChute. an interview I did a few years back with Brian Ruhe, R-U-H-E. You can find that pretty easily on BitChute and others I've done. Meanwhile, we have Sal, did you want to ask a further question or are you good?
No, I'm good for now. I'll stick around in case, anything else comes up. And thanks, guys.
Well, I'm glad you called in, Sal. Scaredy Cat is here. Scaredy, join the conversation.
Hi, Jim and Tom. Also, hello to Sal from Colorado and Bruce from Texas, I think. So,
yes.
Hey, I have a couple of points. I absolutely loved Tom, your point about hands-on education, and it combines with my own intense desire. It dovetails desire for the side hustle, which I think every human being should have, or start one. Everybody should target, maybe if they can find one person to give them $50 for something they love in their life. So you are love engineering. And so I had some homework for you. Can you find a family, just one kid, even if it's a little four-year-old? And because you intensely live nature, live science, and math, after all, is just the language of nature, a language of thinking, language of measurement. You could work with them. Family would be delighted to have such a real person. And then slowly you could build him up, starting from 4-year-old, hopefully 10 years from now, you could build up to the Navier-Stokes equations of the subject of fluid dynamics. But even a little 4-year-old, teachers increasingly just teach on screens. If it's, they have iPad screens, they have presentation movie screens, and they apply a pre-written lesson that's maybe probably somebody else typed up. And so it's becoming almost exclusive, and humanity is losing touch with reality. And often the school teacher, she herself might not know the subject, so she relies on, pre-made things. And the American Federation of Teachers, for example, I forget her name. She's a lesbian out of a church in Brooklyn, which is an exclusive church for all those alphabets, LGBTQ. So teachers, take time out of a child's life, hours and hours, it seems, now to devote to social propaganda, which don't have any place in a tender little child's mind and soul. And so go ahead. I did have a second point, but I think I've already talked too much.
Go ahead, Tom, if you'd like to feel.
I really appreciate what you're saying, Scaredy Cat. The kind of stuff you're talking about really resonates with me. Side hustle wise, I clearly I'm not made for the corporate life. I have I employ myself. And, as far as finding a family and working with them, I'm always on the lookout for, friends and stuff like that. Any kid who kind of shows a certain amount of interest in certain things, we're always trying to help each other out. There's a lot of kids who want to fly, and I have friends who are pilots and are always happy to engage them in those kind of things. And I think this is part of just being kind of like developing the world that you want to live in, is to do exactly what you're describing, is just make yourself available, put yourself out there and help people become what they want to become. Because the reality is how many people are, you're born into a certain family, you know, what your family knows about is not necessarily what, you know, the child born into that family wants to become. And so essentially to have a group of people who are kind of like-minded and feeling very positive about helping every individual achieve the greatest of their potential in the ways that whatever that means to them, really, because, I mean, that's a, you know, this idea that success is just, you know, having a high paying job and, you know, retiring young or something like that so that you can go fishing and play golf. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, when you're talking about teachers these days, I remember something that I discovered when I was in grad school, which is that teachers are, and I mean, like the people who go to education school, and this is true at like top education schools like Columbia and Stanford or Harvard, and it's also true at kind of like just a podunk university, is that teachers are basically the dumbest people on the campuses. If you go look at the GRE scores, really nothing, nobody scores lower than teachers, and yet these are the people who are being tasked with educating the next generation. It almost seems criminal to me that you're basically allowing the dumbest, the most manipulable, the most unmotivated. I mean, they just they can't even take the time to study for the GRE. I mean, like, what's your problem? All right, I mean, it seems absolutely crazy. And when you consider that, you know, a typical public school education consists of approximately 180 days a year times about 6 hours a day for 12 years or something like that, do the math, it's 13,000 hours in a school. And if you think, if you put your mind to doing anything for 13,000 hours, do you think that you would be as incompetent as almost every, I mean, like the vast majority of high school students who graduate? They don't know anything. They don't know anything useful. I mean, that's most of them. Obviously, some of them have extracurricular stuff and they learn something that's actually useful. But the idea that kids spend 13,000 hours in a school and essentially are kind of just barely able to make it through life with that that schooling is just seems like a complete absurdity to me. 13,000 hours at those age when you can learn almost anything, and you have free time, no jobs, nothing to really interfere with your education, people should be walking out of this experience knowing a tremendous amount. Because I've homeschooled my kids, I have a lot of experience with just the disparity between what happens in schools versus what happens with kids. My experience is that kids do not need very much hands-on instruction. Like, it, once they learn to read, if you can read, you can teach yourself everything else you need to know. And it's certainly wonderful to have other people to bounce ideas off with, talk about things, work through problems and so on. But I absolutely believe that the school system exists to diminish people, not build them up.
Scaredy, go ahead. I think that was a very well-received comment you raised and questions. Go ahead with more.
Hey, thanks, Jim and Tom. So just a follow-up, and then we might not have time for my other point. So Brenda Lebsack, L-E-B, like Lebanon, and then sack, like a sack of potatoes. And Brenda is B as in beautiful, R-E-N, like Norway, D like daffodil A. So normal spelling, Brenda Lebsack. So I think Stanford is in California, and Brenda Lebsack, she's a teacher of like a 20 years, maybe a quarter century, and she's mightily fighting our toddlers being given pornography, which is what these lessons are. She has little 4 or 5 minute videos showing books specifically made for, you know, what I call anus insertions. I refuse to use the beautiful word gay, which just meant, you know, youthful happiness. It would be great if you contacted her, maybe, and it would be fantastic if Jim had maybe both of you on, and because she's a real good-souled, hearted teacher fighting, and you have the, you know, study of nature. And my second point is plastic and electricity. These two items are what the wicked, powerful rulers are using to get the entire universe into their ownership, destroying everything for everybody else. For example, I noticed the supermarket buggies, instead of being steel now, all of a sudden, in the past a year or so, they've all turned into plastic buggies. There was the coin shortage. Weird. There's no reason for coins to suddenly, you know, have a deficit or, you know, disappear. And I noticed during COVID that the new coins that are being minted, they had a weird kind of excessive shininess, like aluminum or tinsel or something. So you're an engineer. Come back, Tom, and tell us. Because I'm just thinking, as you know, as we get more and more side hustles and people start making money, and maybe a welder wants to make hammers, and then the wicked, powerful human monsters we have are just going to say, oh, we don't have enough steel. How can you go around? Because melting plastic for hammerheads.
Scaredy, yeah. We got to give Tom a chance to respond. Tom, go for it.
I really do think that we are heading into a new world. You know, we're going to bifurcate. There's going to be the people who go along with the system, but I think there's going to be a good fraction of us who are headed the opposite direction, and we're going to just have to create our own way of doing things. You know, it's educationally, you know, raising up the next generation, and just spiritually, physically, all these kind of things, we have to just bind together and create the world we want to see, because they're obviously not going to do it for us. I've had some very strong feelings about where education could go, because I think it's so critical in terms of the longer term directions that any society is headed. And I do believe that, you know, there's quite a number of us who feel completely fed up with the directions that have been given to us, and that we're going to do something about it.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. I want to thank Bruce and Sal and Scaredy for calling in, Tom. You've just been an exceptionally good guest. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. I look forward to having you back in the future, my friend. Any final thoughts?
Hey, well, this is the first time I've ever done anything like this, and I just really appreciate you making it so easy, and it's just been a total pleasure. I've, 2 hours went by real fast, and I appreciate everything you said. Thank you.
Well, you have a wonderful background knowledge and great clarity of thought and articulation, Tom. You've just been a sensational guest here on The Raw Deal. Thank you so much. Everyone, have a great weekend and spend as much time as you can with friends and loved ones. We do not know how much time we have left.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I've pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect, Triangle. Live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
We'll be right back.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was